This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Today's show is about the 2020 FAFSA, and there's a lot to talk about. But given the news yesterday that suggests the UAW strike might be about to end, we wanted to check in with Samantha Horton, who's been covering this for us. We talked to her less than an hour ago. Indiana Public Broadcasting, Samantha Horton's with us. Hi, Samantha.
Hi, Matt. Thanks for having me.
The UAW reached a proposed tentative agreement with GM yesterday. Can you break down what's happening and what we know right now?
Yeah, so there's a tentative agreement out there right now that leadership from UAW local chapters is up in Detroit right now discussing it, and then we'll be voting on it. So once they vote, if it gets approved, then it will be passed on to the rest of the membership throughout the nation to vote on.
And you've been out on the picket lines talking to union workers. What have you heard from them?
Yeah, so they're cautiously optimistic is, I think, the phrase that I've heard from a couple of them, in the sense of it's good news. They've described they want to go back to work. The strike was not a thing that was decided on lightly. And so they're hopeful that the tentative agreement will be what they have been fighting for and believe is fair for them to be receiving. And so I think they are ready to see what the new proposed contract would include and are hopeful then that means that they can vote in favor of it and then get back to doing their jobs.
Do we know when more information might come out? What's the next step?
So yes, up in Detroit right now, leadership is meeting. They're learning about what the tentative agreement is, and they will be casting their votes on that tentative agreement. So that's pretty much the big thing right now that's being focused on. They went into meeting this morning from what I've seen in reports and what, you know, membership has heard here in Indiana. So I think that's pretty much now waiting to hear what comes out of that meeting. The other thing that will come out of that meeting will be those who are in attendance will also vote whether to end the strike before all membership votes or to wait until everyone has gotten a chance to vote and see if the tentative agreement is approved with all members being able to cast their vote.
A possible end to a strike that's gone on for just over a month now. Samantha Horton, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
And I'm sure we'll know more tomorrow when we round up the biggest state stories of the week on the Friday pitch-in, so tune in at this time tomorrow for that. But right now, we're going to dig into the topic of student financial aid. The federal application for federal student aid for the 2020 school year went up last week. The FAFSA is crucial for many Indiana students. For some, it can make or break their chances in an education. So we wanted to help unpack all the ins and outs of completing it and get a better picture of what it all means. What's been your experience with financial aid for school? Was it confusing? Did you get what you needed? What would have made it better? Let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. Joining me live in the studio is Barbie Martin. Barbie is Director of School and Community Outreach at the Indiana Commission for Higher Education. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Colby Schenck is Associate Commissioner for Student Financial Aid at that same commission. Thanks, Colby. Oh,
thank you very much.
And Bill Wozniak is Vice President of Marketing for InvestEd. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon.
Barbie, I want to start with you. Super basic question. What is FAFSA?
FAFSA is a federal form that students fill out, but we also use that same form in Indiana. There are some states that have their own documentation as well, but in Indiana, we get everything we need from that form. So when students fill out the FAFSA, they are actually determining their eligibility for both federal aid and Indiana state aid. So one-stop shop.
You and Colby work at the Indiana Commission for Higher Education. What role does the commission have in this for students in Indiana?
Well, Colby can explain his role with the financial aid piece. I work directly with schools, community organizations, families. I'm in charge of our outreach efforts for the K-12 side of the commission, and we work directly with students. I supervise 8 outreach staff that are across the state in those communities, and we work directly with the schools. We go when we host events at different things like Ivy Tech this coming Saturday. We have a big FAFSA filing event, and everyone is welcome. We target our 21st Century Scholars. It's one of our big financial aid programs, but the events are open to all. We have parents who come in and help their students file, and then they sometimes end up deciding to file. They want to go back and get some education, and so that's always exciting when we have parents and their seniors in high school are filing together.
Anything to add, Colby, with regard to financial aid?
Yeah, as Barbie mentioned, the free application for federal student aid, that's also the way that you apply for not just for your federal student aid, but also for your state financial aid. So financial aid that we provide at the state of Indiana. It's also the way that many colleges and universities, the application that colleges and universities use to award student aid as well. So it's a very important form. And it's important that students file it, but it's also important that they file it by our April 15th deadline. We have a deadline for students to file the FAFSA to qualify for our two largest need-based financial aid programs, the 21st Century Scholarship, as well as our Frank O'Bannon Grant.
Some of the reason that we're talking about this on the show is there's concern about how much people know about this. What's your sense for that right now? Does the average high school student know enough about financial aid?
I think it varies by school. Some schools, you know, they start driving this home when the students are younger. They start having these kinds of discussions with their freshmen, with their sophomores. Other schools, it kind of gets lost in the shuffle sometimes. But that's our role. We're trying to get the message out there. We have social media. We directly message the students that are part of our program so that we have contact information for them. We send printed materials to all the schools in Indiana. And we really start having this discussion with students as early as 7th or 8th grade so that when they get to senior year, they're a little more comfortable. They've at least heard of it. They know some of the basics. And then we're all here to help them through the process.
Whose job is it to make students aware of their options and how the process works?
I feel like it's all of our jobs. We have communication staff at the commission, and they do social media. They do press releases. We do all kinds of event planning. We send those materials to the schools to hand out. There's actually, starting next year, schools are going to be required to give a printed handout to all seniors about the FAFSA. But I think it really falls to all of us. We have our community partners like Bill's group from InvestEd, Big Brothers Big Sisters, United Way, all these kind of community groups across the state help with these kind of events.
Including our high schools and our colleges throughout the state.
Yes.
Well, let's get into some of the details of that process. Colby, what do you need to file FAFSA?
So you need to have your Social Security number. As a student, you need your Social Security number. You need to know your name and your date of birth. That's how you start the application. And then you need to provide some income information as well. So and how much? So that could include your tax forms, your federal tax forms. It includes W-2. And it also may ask you for how much cash you have in your bank account. So having a copy of your bank statements is also helpful to complete the FAFSA.
Barbie.
And it's important to note for this year's FAFSA, that's 2018 tax information.
Ah, gotcha. And which parent should you file with?
It depends on the student's living situation. You file usually with a custodial parent. That may be one parent. It may be both parents if they're still in the same household. It could be a parent and a step parent. But it depends on the student's living situation. And there are some situations, if they're independent, they don't provide any parent information. If they are married, if they have a child of their own that they support financially at least 50%, if they've ever experienced foster care from the age of 13 on, or if they've been in legal guardianship from the age of 13 on. In those circumstances, they file as an independent student, and it's just their information.
Applications for the 2020 school year opened last week. What's the timeline like from here on out? You mentioned the April 15th deadline. When should people be filing, though?
Right now.
As soon as possible.
And Colby, have you found that the sooner the better?
The sooner the better, absolutely, because we do have our April 15th deadline. That's our deadline for our Frank O'Bannon Grant and our 21st Century Scholarship. But you know, we don't want students to wait until the last minute to file. We don't want them to wait until April 15th. If they run into issues, there are resources that can help them. InvestEd, Bill with InvestEd is here, and it's a great resource for helping students file the FAFSA. But starting early, going through it slowly, trying to figure out, what maybe the pain points are for an individual family, and if you do run into those and you need help, that you have time to be able to reach out and to get help.
Colby, what's the range of support students can get?
So we provide a lot of really good resources on our website at learnmoreindiana.org. And of course, we always refer students to Invested. Invested is a great community partner here in the state. And Bill, I don't know how many individuals you help in a typical year throughout the state, but it's a very, very large number.
Yeah, six to 8,000 individual calls, emails, answers, you know, family questions answered, 16 to 1700 FAFSAs filed, things along that nature. But families have questions, and we want Hoosiers to know that there's help for them available.
Yeah. Does getting this aid in Indiana work differently than other states?
Well, one of the things when you mentioned, you know, the deadline when people should file, in some states, it's sort of a derby. It's first come, first serve. You don't file on October 1, you don't get the aid. It's kind of like that. And that's not the case here. At the same time, you do not want to put this off because the colleges have their deadlines, right? The colleges will say, we want this by November 1 or November 10 or getting those types of things done. So you have deadlines, you have these pressure situations, but families have options with the commission and other partners that will help them so that in Indiana, there's so many free options. Options available. No family should ever skip filing for any reason.
So then why does the amount of assistance you can get change state to state, Barbie?
We've been very fortunate. Bipartisan legislature, they've always supported financial aid in the state of Indiana. They look at that return on investment and what it brings to the community. We have a big goal in Indiana where by 2025, we want 60% of people to have some sort of post-secondary credential because that's what the job market is going to require. And that's everything from high-need, high-yield certificates all the way through traditional college degrees. So we want to make sure people understand that as well, that when we say college, it doesn't have to be just that traditional four-year college where you live in a dorm on a campus. It can be community college. It can be a certificate program. So that's the important thing. A lot of people think, well, I'm not going to go away to school for 4 years. It doesn't have to be that. There is aid to help people right in their own communities, much shorter terms, to fit the needs that they have.
And in the last few seconds we have in this segment, and we'll keep you all for the next segment, what are the best places people can go to answer questions they might have about FAFSA?
On our website, Colby mentioned it before, learnmoreindiana.org, InvestEd has resources, or you can go to the federal government website too, which is FAFSA.gov, G-O-V.
Barbie Martin is Director of School and Community Outreach at the Indiana Commission for Higher Education. Colby Shank is Associate Commissioner for Student Financial Aid at that same commission. Bill Wozniak is Vice President of Marketing for InvestEd. And up next, we'll talk more about financial aid, what options are available to students in Indiana, and how things might be changing. As always, we'd love your questions and comments on social media. Was it a challenge for you to navigate financial aid options? What would make it easier? What impact has financial aid had on your life? Let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to our conversation on financial aid, I want to tell you about yesterday's show on Indiana's harvest festivals. We talked to farms around the state about how they invite the public in for a true fall experience. You can find that show and all our shows wherever you get podcasts. Just search for All In Indiana. Today we're talking about FAFSA, the financial aid options for students in Indiana. As always, we'll take your questions and comments and get them to our live panel. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. In the studio, we welcome back Barbie Martin, Director of School and Community Outreach at the Indiana Commission for Higher Education. Thanks for staying, Barbie.
Thank you.
Colby Shank, Associate Commissioner for Student Financial Aid at that same commission. Thanks, Colby.
Thank you.
Bill Wozniak. Bill is Vice President of Marketing at InvestEd. Thanks, Bill.
Thanks so much.
Bill, quickly, can you explain what InvestEd is?
Yes. We might not have enough time, but let's go into it.
We got plenty of time.
Then let's go into it. It's a not-for-profit that has a focus of helping Hoosiers get education, post-secondary education in all the different ways possible with the least debt possible. So families know education is out there, opportunities are out there, but then when they have the questions, how do I pick a college? Where do I look for answers? How do I find financial aid? And how do I file the FAFSA? There's completely free help available for any Hoosier from Hammond all the way to Evansville to Richmond. And we do 560 events a year at high schools mainly, helping out the commission and just being there phone, email, or in person as a supplement complementary not-for-profit tool that just exists there for all Hoosiers.
And resources like yours are really necessary. My mom was a secretary in a guidance office at a high school, and FAFSA was one of her biggest frustrations. And so I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. How do you work with Barbie and Colby and people at the state?
So, well, and what you just said was exactly it. So in 2003, we began going to a couple high schools where they needed some people to help some students. So we started doing that. Those schools talked to a few other schools. We made very good friendships at the commission. And at the commission or these schools, people would say, can you guys go here? Or can you help with 9th and 10th graders learning how to pay for college? And we said, sure. And then it just kept growing and growing and growing, and our staff grew and the phone calls increased. And it's just been this wonderful collaborative relationship with the high schools, the colleges, and of course, our great friends at the commission.
Stephanie from Facebook writes in, every year something seems to be wrong with our forms and it affects our kids' aid. Purdue has been very helpful in fixing it. IU has been more difficult. We also connect directly to our tax forms. Very frustrating. It seems like these kinds of sentiments are fairly common enough to warrant an organization like yours helping out.
We get phone calls and emails every single day. And as we get closer to April 15, those go up exponentially. So file early, please. And so what happens is, and we get every type of question every day. Sometimes it is just a data point here or a data point there. When the questions on the FAFSA ask for certain things, it's not always crystal clear. No family wants to, you know, give a wrong answer. No one wants extra difficulty, but sometimes it's really in the wording. It's really granular. Experts can help get the family on the right page. The state gets what they need. The federal government gets what they need. And Purdue or IU and Purdue both get what they need, too. I made sure to say that both ways.
you have interventions with students as young as 9th grade to help them start planning for college. Is it easy to get kids that age to worry about something that, to some of them, it probably feels like 100 years away?
It absolutely does. To seniors in high school, it sometimes feels 100 years away. But we've talked with Barbie and our friends at the commission that someday we hope to be at every maternity ward where we say to the parents, hey, you know, oh, beautiful baby, here's some information on the state, you know, grant programs. We're not there yet, but that's sort of our goal someday. But in 9th grade, it's more the parents. But again, even in 11th and 12th grade, it's often the parents of the student that are really keyed in. When the students graduate college and they have some debt or they have some things that they really want to focus on, by the time they get to about 21, they seem really keyed in. But in 9th, 10th, even 11th and 12th grade, it's often the parents where we're making the headway on sort of planning ahead.
Is there an example of a specific detail in this paperwork that a lot of people get wrong?
Maybe it starts with the question we addressed. One of our most common questions is which parent should file the FAFSA? Literally our number one question, I believe. I don't know.
I think you're right, Bill. I think that is probably one of the top questions that we get, too.
And how much of a difference can it make for kids and parents to start planning that far in advance? Back to our previous question about getting to them in the maternity ward.
Huge. Exponential. In Indiana here, if you put $5,000 for those families that are able, if you put $5,000 into a 529, the money grows tax-free. You get a generous 20% rebate on your Indiana taxes. So if you paid over $1,000 or you're obligated to pay over $1,000 in your Indiana taxes, you get that back. So literally, you can put $5,000 away that's going to grow tax-free. You get $1,000 right back in your taxes the next year. So right there, you have a huge advantage. But then when you look at the tools that the commission has on their website, the free tools that are available, where families are looking at colleges, okay, what programs are available? What are the deadlines? What is going to be our net price for this particular school? And they start doing that examination. They get on the right track. It can make tens of thousands of dollars of difference per family if they don't miss deadlines, get all the available aid, really examine the college or certificate options, and make strong choices. It's a huge amount.
starting this year, high schools and the Commission for Higher Education will better track who files for federal aid through a data share agreement authorized by state lawmakers earlier this year. What effect will this have, do you think? Why is tracking important, Barbie?
It's a great tool for those school counselors. We've had this program in the past, but this is the first year that it's been part of state law. And it actually lets the school see student-level data. So they can pull a report if they have this agreement on file, and they can see, okay, these 10 kids have filed, but these five haven't. So it allows them to have those more personal conversations and find out, have you filed and we just haven't gotten it yet? Are you going to file? Do you have questions? And then they have those resources if a student is unsure. Oh, well, Ivy Tech in Indianapolis, the commission's having an event Saturday. You should go. College Goal Sunday is November 3rd. You should go. So it really gives them the tool rather than just telling all students you need to file the FAFSA and half of them already have. It lets them really hone those efforts and communicate where they need to.
What about federal legislation? Has anything passed or is anything being worked on that might make changes to financial aid on the national level?
So currently we are in the U.S. Congress is preparing for reauthorization of the Higher Education Act. So there's a number of proposals that have been filed by representatives and senators. There's a lot of different proposals out there, and there's new ones seem to be being filed on a very regular basis. But there are some common trends. One in particular is extending the Pell Grant to shorter term certificate programs and programs that allow individuals to get some type of workplace credential. So that's one of the things that we're, at least is on our radar, that we're noticing.
And there's a lot of campaign speak among, particularly among the Democratic nominees, potential nominees for president who will be running next year in the 2020 election. Have you paid attention to that? And what seems to stick out to you, if anything?
Well, our focus is on our state financial aid programs and trying to administer them the best way that we can. There's a lot of different legislative proposals that are being introduced, including, I believe, the Democrats introduced their proposal for the Higher Education Act reauthorization. So we're monitoring it, but we're laser focused on our state aid programs and administering them.
The only thing we get some families over the last few months where families at a financial aid night will say something along the lines of, well, even if we overborrow, it's getting forgiven. It's getting wiped away. And that may happen. I don't have a crystal ball. But we do warn families that if you plan and you just borrow too much and it doesn't get forgiven, you could put yourself in a really bad position. So we just emphasize strong, rigid, great planning ahead. And then maybe down the road, if everything gets forgiven, then it gets forgiven. But we don't want families to overborrow thinking that's a slam dunk.
Along those lines, Mickey from Twitter wants to know, are there any resources for managing student loans after graduating that we know of? Barbie?
There are all kinds of different resources depending on how you've borrowed, especially if you have private loans. Often those can be refinanced to a lower interest rate. If you have federal loans, there are various different payment plans available. Some are based on income. You can have extended time depending on the situation. And there are still options available to apply for student loan forgiveness. But as Bill said, that's not guaranteed. But definitely do some research out there. There are some agencies that do it as a third-party organization, and I'll let Bill speak to that. And then also federally, if you go onto the federal website, there are options to reorganize your loans if you're having trouble paying.
Anything to add, Bill?
Yeah, your servicer is always the sort of first point. Work with your servicer. Always look on the Department of Ed site. I just helped a family last weekend with income-driven repayment, and so that the amount you owe is based on what your income is. And sometimes if families are having a tough time, that can go very, very low, and you're not defaulting, things of that nature, and then you can go beyond that. But that's a really good starting place, I think.
Let's talk about how things are changing around financial aid and college tuition. What trends have we seen on the number of students enrolling in financial aid? Barbie?
So,
Or Colby?
Overall, the FAFSA completion rate has remained fairly stable, decreasing a little bit both nationally and here in the state of Indiana. So we're really excited to be here to try to promote FAFSA completion and to highlight some of the new tools that we're rolling out, particularly with the data sharing agreements and the FAFSA notification, to try to boost those numbers.
Bill, you've been at InvestEd since 2003. How have things changed since then?
Oh, my goodness. Well, the only constant is change. And so things go back and forth and the different things out there. Like right now, I was at a conference yesterday, on the horizon of income share agreements, right? This whole topic. So that's really appeared and sort of taken the whole environment by storm. So you have that going on. But over time, we have how many births there are, right? How many citizens, how many students are of a certain age? We always deal with the economy. So when the economy goes worse, more people head back to college. And so you have to scramble that way. The economy gets better. People sort of walk away from education a little bit. So you have all those forces. But over the last 15 years, the amount of aid available in Indiana per student, per resident, has been very strong compared to nationally. There are generous programs available. And as the cost of college over these last 15 years has crept up, grant availability has gone up at the same time, and we just want to make sure families put themselves in position to get the grants that are available.
Barbie?
We also encourage students. I always give this example. I think students hear it better when they realize it's a personal experience. My senior year of high school was a little bit ago, but I always tell the story. There was one scholarship that I got my senior year going into my first year of college that I got because I was literally the only qualified student who applied for it. And it was $500. And back then, that was a lot of money, but I would take $500 now. I wrote an essay, had to fill out a form, and I got $500 toward my first year of college. So there are opportunities out there. I wouldn't have been able to get that aid, though, without filing the FAFSA. It went through my college. The college required that the FAFSA be filed to administer that aid. So that's always the first place we want kids to start. There are so many options out there, but this really is the jumping off point.
Is it a challenge, Barbie, to help students all across Indiana to get information and training on this? What about rural and faraway corners of the state?
That is something that is a challenge often. A lot of schools that have difficulty with the technology, but that's where my outreach staff, Bill's staff, we go wherever the need is. If a school wants us to come in, a lot of times we invite Bill's staff to piggyback on our events, and then we do the same with him. My outreach staff piggybacks with his events. And so that way you have FAFSA experts, you have state financial aid experts, and wherever that may be, urban schools or rural schools, wherever the case is.
No school has been told no in all the years that we've been collaborating together. No school who said, no matter where, any corner of the state, hey, we want to ramp things up a little bit. We want to put on a couple events. We want to do whatever. As long as it's helping their students and it's about financial aid and awareness and FAFSA filing and all that, no school has been told no.
Oh, Bill, what is the Indiana Student Financial Aid Association?
A wonderful association. So those are great friends of ours, and Barbie and I serve on committees, volunteer on committees and all that. It is the group that was the first group of its kind, okay, way back over 75 years ago. It started right here in Indiana. The financial aid administrators from Purdue and IU and Ivy Tech and all the wonderful schools in Indiana, they got together and they agreed to share information and help students over 75 years ago. And that's the entity that puts on College Goal Sunday, and the commission volunteers and we volunteer and everybody gets behind it. But they do wonderful programs and they work together, the financial aid administrators from all the Indiana colleges and universities.
And some of those colleges, of course, have their own programs to help students. Purdue has Back a Boiler, which they call a new innovative option to fund a Purdue education. How does that work?
And there you have it. That's where we get into the income share agreements. And we're at ground zero. I was at a couple conferences in September, and you walk in and your name tag has Indiana on it. And so right away, everybody comes over and says, now what's happening at Purdue and what's going on and where's this all going to go? So right away, you're an expert.
Is it really that sort of innovative and sort of groundbreaking?
Well, in this space, in this sort of little space that we all occupy, it's a real big deal with how everybody is looking for solutions. We all hear about the $1.6 trillion of student loan debt. And so some people say, we'll just write a check and forgive it. And other people say, well, that might not work, so maybe we should limit loans, or maybe we're going to adjust the cost of college, or maybe states are going to double their grants. And all of these things are on the table, but they all have sort of limitations. So when you get to the income share agreement and you say to a student, you say, come to the school, we're going to get behind you, you're not going to make a payment or sign a loan per se, but now we're going to look at 3% of your income for 8 years after graduation, it's an interesting concept. Can it work? Will it work? How will all it play out? Those details remain to be seen, but it's happening live at Purdue.
Are there other schools trying interesting ways to help provide assistance?
Absolutely. And everybody goes about it different ways. But like the University of Utah, we heard from Norwich University yesterday at the conference in Philadelphia I was at. Other schools are going along these lines, but they're all coming at it in a slightly different way. Purdue has its model. These other schools have their models about how they're doing it. But then other entities, other schools, with how they package up grants or they piggyback on the 21st Century Scholar Grant, those are creative things, too, I believe.
Bill Wozniak, he's the Vice President of Marketing at InvestEd. Thank you for your time, Bill.
Thank you so much.
And I want to thank everyone for coming in today. Barbie Martin, Director of School and Community Outreach at the Indiana Commission for Higher Education. Thank you.
Thank you.
Colby Shank, Associate Commissioner for Student Financial Aid at that same commission. Colby, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Up next, we will close out the show with a recent conversation I had with Julie Manning Magid, a professor of business law at Indiana University, to talk about the history and current state of pregnancy discrimination in Indiana. Do working women who want to start a family get a fair shake in the state? And what more needs to be done to catch up with the rest of the country and the world? I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Many women have dealt with pregnancy discrimination. It's cost some women jobs, even careers. Here to talk about some of the history of pregnancy discrimination is Professor of Business Law at Indiana University, Julie Manning Magid. Hi, Julie.
Hi. So nice to see you.
We're talking about pregnancy discrimination in part because Senator Elizabeth Warren recently said she was fired from a teaching job in 1971 for being pregnant. She's aiming to be the Democratic nominee for president, so it's to be expected that anything she says will be challenged. But there was pushback from some that questioned her story. Before we get into all the details and the history around pregnancy discrimination, what did you make of the way that story played out and the way that it was covered in the media?
Well, I was surprised that it was a surprise to anyone that a woman would be fired for her job for being pregnant in 1971. That is what happened. It happened to my mother. It happened to everyone. There was no law that stopped women from losing their job because of pregnancy until 1978. This was after Title VII of the Civil Rights Act passed in 1964 that said discrimination because of sex was prohibitive in the workplace. Nonetheless, that was interpreted as not being pregnancy, and women were continued to asked to leave their job when they became pregnant.
So what was then the Pregnancy Discrimination Act?
So Title VII, again, of the Civil Rights Act passed in 1964, had that because of sex language in it that the courts said that doesn't mean pregnancy. Most courts did. It was taken all the way to the United States Supreme Court in 1976. There was a case called General Electric v. Gilbert. And the Supreme Court said, yeah, that doesn't mean pregnancy, particularly because there are women who are not pregnant or able to become pregnant, and there are men who are not pregnant or able to become pregnant, and therefore this isn't a distinction because of the classification of sex. And because there were categories of men and women in the non-pregnant side, and only women were in the pregnant side, they said that doesn't count. So the good news is Congress realized that was a ridiculous outcome, and the very next year passed an amendment to Title VII, which we now refer to as the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, that basically said we meant pregnancy too. when we said because of sex in Title VII. The problem with the way they said we meant pregnancy too is a very short, not worded particularly well, and that's only led to many other questions about what really pregnancy discrimination means. And we continue to litigate that. There was a 2015 United States Supreme Court decision, Young versus United Parcel Services, that talked about whether you have to provide accommodation to a pregnant worker when you provide accommodation to other workers on light restricted duty.
Let's jump into the 90s.
Okay.
Can you explain what the Family and Medical Leave Act of 1993 was?
Yes.
How does that relate to the issue we're talking about?
It relates quite closely because many people will say Family and Medical Leave Act of 93 sort of solved the pregnancy discrimination act's problems. I am one who does not believe that is true. It solved some problems and it created others. One of the ideas behind the Family and Medical Leave Act is we need to have both parents participating in the process of leave to take care of their children. And so what it really did was give an opportunity to leave to both men and women on the birth of a child, adoption of a child, and other issues unrelated to childbirth. But the problem with this is that women who have babies actually have a physical event, biological event going on that oftentimes requires additional medical time off, even if it's fairly routine, you're taking appointments, et cetera. All that eats into their time for childcare after, in a way that's just simply not true for, you know, non-birthing parents. The other problem with Family and Medical Leave Act is it applies to employers who have 50 or more employees. So even though it covers the largest employers, it doesn't cover the largest number of employers because most of our employers are small and mid-sized companies that don't fall under the Family and Medical Leave Act. A lot of states have tried to ameliorate some of these issues around pregnancy and Family and Medical Leave Act with adding their own state-based restrictions around this. Indiana has not. They sort of stand out as one of the states that has done very little in pregnancy protection. So people in Indiana have an additional burden that people in other states don't.
This is actually something that I just dealt with. I have a 2-month-old at home and a 2-year-old. And actually, when our 2-year-old was born, it was our first child, my wife helped to develop her employer's pregnancy leave policy because she was the first woman who worked there to get pregnant while on the job.
Right.
And she was able to kind of help craft it. But even then, she, you know, there are, as you said, very few state laws in Indiana that sort of help her out in that case. And she does work for an employer who I would say is fairly progressive. But even then, it came up very limited. If you look at what they're doing, what her employer did and what almost any other employer does in Indiana, and then you look at countries in Scandinavia, and there's no comparison.
Right. When I talk about this with my graduate students, they're always surprised because there's a whole classroom of people who have very different experiences. There's those who work for large employers who think that FMLA is great because everybody's covered and they get paid time off and doesn't everybody get maternity leave? And they're shocked to hear from their colleagues who say, no, we don't get paid time off. We have to use all our vacation. If it's used during sick leave or something that the pregnancy required, then we have really nothing paid left. And so the protection is very different depending on who your employer is, what your situation is. And I think we need to also point out that, you know, we are in a country that has one of the worst maternal mortality rates in the developed nation. We are in a state that is the third worst of those that give data on maternal mortality. All of this is connected. We have to be better about taking care of women to be able to work and have children, because it's good for families. It's important to you. It's not just important to your wife.
Can you give me an example of some of the laws that other states have passed? What can states do to address this?
So what happens that the states usually try to do is fill in the gaps. So Title VII only applies to employers of 15 or more employees. FMLA, as I said, 50 employees. So Indiana, for instance, according to Department of Labor statistics, is one of four states with no employment protection for working mothers pregnant or nursing during their pregnancy or nursing time. So there's a variety of ways that people have tried to fill in, both for smaller employers who aren't impacted by federal legislation, which just says we cover the smaller employers, you know, more than one employee, we're going to cover like the federal legislation does. Indiana is one of five states with no protection against pregnancy discrimination on a state level at all. And so, you know, at a minimum, you could start there. So there's a variety of approaches states have taken. I don't know if any state does it perfectly, but I do think that a march toward the reality of women working, needing to work to provide for their families, and being pregnant, possibly having medical complications related to that pregnancy, is a fact that we're all have evolved enough to have a serious conversation about.
And so it seems like there have been efforts in Indiana. Have they gotten shut down for some reason? It's just a political challenge?
I think that political challenges is part of it. There are some efforts now around the maternal mortality, which I think is a great way to approach this. Let's not think about it just, you know, I think that there's a lot to be thought of in terms of women and work, but let's talk about the place we're in crisis, the maternal mortality crisis that exists here.
And everyone's talking about that on all sides of the political spectrum.
Absolutely. And it's a much easier way to bring all different issues together. And, you know, what's happened so far in this state on that issue is that in 2018, there was a state law passed that created a review board that includes government officials and healthcare experts to really review what's going on. And it is now required that every maternal death in the state is reported, so that review board has an opportunity to review it. My concern is that they're reviewing more for the medical concerns and not enough for the legislative issues, because those are connected. It's not just a healthcare issue of access to healthcare and awareness of the dangers of maternal mortality, but there's also a when women have to keep their job and they're pregnant, they take risks that they shouldn't take, and we need to protect them from that.
How much of a challenge is it right now to identify the root causes of maternal mortality?
It's a huge challenge.
Because there are a lot of different reasons for it.
I think it's one of these problems that it sounds like a medical problem, but it also is an issue for people in poverty, rural, with access to care is a bigger issue. It's all so multifaceted that It like the old story of the blind people who are trying to identify the elephant, and depending on which part you feel, that's what it is.
Yeah.
It's a little like that. And I think the only way to save women's lives, save children's lives, is to think of it holistically. And that's pregnancy discrimination, it's healthcare access, it's understanding the education for awareness around these issues, it's insurance concerns. It's a very complicated picture.
Harvard Business Review looked into this earlier this year. Some of the interesting facts that it found were that the U.S. maternal mortality rate more than doubled from 10.3 per 100,000 live births in 1991 to 23.8 in 2014. Over 700 women a year die of complications related to pregnancy every year in the U.S. Two-thirds of those deaths are preventable. 50,000 women suffer from life-threatening complications of pregnancy. Do you think that there's enough education about these issues right now? Are people aware of these problems or how they can be solved?
No, I think absolutely not. And I would be interested to hear from your listeners, because I think they'll be shocked by those statistics. They should be shocked by those statistics that women and children are dying for simply not having adequate care during the pregnancy process. I do think that there is gaining attention. There's a couple of groups that are trying to shine a light on this, and certainly I commend those in the state who were involved with passing that law to get a review committee going in 2018. It's so important, but it's important for employers to think about the insurance options they're providing, because C-sections are too frequent and they do have inherent risks associated with them. But it's also important to think in terms of, again, the legislation, pregnancy discrimination, leave rights. One of the most dangerous times is after a woman has been released from the hospital. Many people die after going home, then having a child to take care of and not being aware that there's real risk that they could die from childbirth. I just don't think we talk about that very often. And we should, and we can bring down the numbers dramatically, because the United States is, like I said, one of the worst in the developed world. There are good examples from around the world of how to have healthier outcomes during pregnancy.
Let's look at an argument that a business-minded person might make with regard to this. Why should I pay someone who's not coming to work? The benefits of taking care of a pregnant woman who works for you perhaps aren't as easily defined.
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. And there is, when you look at the history of the court cases around this, what you see is almost a resentment about women choosing to have a child and knowing that's going to take their time away from work. Or once they've had one, they'll have another, which has happened to your family, right? And it happened to mine as well. It's pretty common. The fact that we look at that as something that is a negative for our workplaces.
Or a liability.
Or a liability for our workplaces. When if people get sick with cancer, if people get need to have surgery, the list goes on and on. We don't blame somebody for their time away. We encourage them to take care of themselves and come back. So I think, for one, we have to change this attitude that somehow a woman has chosen to hurt the company or the business by deciding to have a family. This is something that we presumably as a society would support and encourage, and it impacts every person that we know in this world, somebody's mom, somebody's child, somebody's spouse. And this blame that's associated with women getting pregnant is, I find it just very strange, but it has been identified in research. A 2012 article called it the pregnancy penalty and said that it was a bigger penalty than what we associate with the motherhood penalty, which is that the wage gap expands once you become a mother, much more so than looking just at genders. When you include the motherhood, the wage gap increases. Fathers actually earn more after they become fathers. So it's an interesting, strange dichotomy that we are putting on women and not men who are also having children in the workplace.
What impact, finally, do you hope that the Maternal Mortality Review Committee will ultimately have?
Well, I hope ultimately no woman dies in childbirth in this state, in this country. I understand that that is maybe not realistic, but we should not, Indiana should not be one of the worst states in a country that is one of the worst places to give birth. At the minimum, I want to see us developing innovative, holistic, inclusive solutions and saying that this is something that we as a state can tackle and lead on. And it begins with legislation, it continues with healthcare access, and it continues with insurers and others who can all participate in making a change for families all across this state and country.
Julie Manning Magid, professor of business law at Indiana University, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Chris Flood and Adam Gross, who also composed our theme music. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Join us tomorrow for the Friday Pitch-In, where we catch up on the biggest Indiana stories of the week. We'll also unpack a recent report by Indiana Public Broadcasting environmental reporter Rebecca Thiel. Of course, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. We'll be back tomorrow for that. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.